for at that time that ocean was navigable, since it had an island in front of the mouth which you call, as you say, the Pillars of Heracles, and this island exceeded Libya and Asia together in size, and from it travellers of that time could pass to the other islands, and from the islands to the whole opposite continent that surrounds that true sea. For what lies within the mouth we speak of appears to be a harbour with a narrow entrance, but that other is truly a sea, and the land surrounding it may most rightly be called a continent in the full sense. On this island of Atlantis there arose a great and marvellous power of kings, ruling the whole island and many other islands as well as parts of the mainland. And besides this, of the lands within our region, they ruled Libya as far as Egypt, and Europe as far as Tyrrhenia. This entire power, gathered into one, once attempted to enslave in a single assault the whole region within the strait, both yours and ours. It was then, Solon, that the power of your city became manifest to all mankind for its excellence and its strength. For surpassing all others in courage of spirit and in the arts of war, leading the Greeks at one point, and at another standing alone of necessity when the others withdrew, having come to the utmost dangers, it overcame the invaders and set up a trophy, prevented those not yet enslaved from being enslaved, and ungrudgingly set free everyone else living inside the boundaries of Heracles. But in later time there came earthquakes of extraordinary violence, and floods with them. One terrible day and night arrived, and the whole of your warrior class was swallowed beneath the ground, while the island of Atlantis went down in the same way under the sea and vanished. That is why even now that sea is impassable and unexplored, blocked by a great quantity of shoal mud which the island left as it settled. You have now heard, Socrates, in brief, what was told by old Crishas on the report of Solon. And when you were speaking yesterday about the constitution and the men you described, I was amazed, recalling to myself these very things I am telling now, realizing how by some marvelous chance, not at all by accident, you had matched much of what Solon said. I did not want to say so at once, however, for after so long a time, my memory of it was not sufficient. So I thought that I ought first to recall everything to myself, thoroughly, before speaking. That is why I so quickly agreed yesterday to what you asked, thinking that, as is the greatest task in all such matters, we would be reasonably well supplied with an account suited to your intentions. And so, as this man said, as soon as I left here yesterday, I began recalling it and going over it with these two, and after I left, I went over nearly everything again in my mind during the night. How true it is, as they say, that what we learn as children makes a marvelous impression. For as for what I heard yesterday, I do not know whether I could recover all of it again in memory. But as for these things I heard so very long ago, I would be altogether astonished if any of them has slipped away from me. It was heard then with great pleasure, and as a kind of game, with the old man teaching me eagerly, since I kept asking him questions again and again, so that it has stayed with me like an indelible dye burned into a picture. And indeed, I told these very things to our friends here first thing this morning, so that they might be well supplied with material along with me. Now then, Socrates, for the very purpose all this has been said, I am ready to tell it, not merely in outline, but in every detail, just as I heard it. And the citizens and the city which you described to us yesterday as if in a myth, we shall now transfer here and set down as being this very city, and we shall say that the citizens you had in mind are those true ancestors of ours whom the priest spoke of. They will fit perfectly, and we shall not be out of tune in saying they are the very people who lived at that time. Working together, all of us will try to render, as far as we can, what is fitting to the task you set us. So we must consider, Socrates, whether this account is to our mind, or whether we should look for some other in its place.
And what could we take up instead of that Crishas, that would suit the goddess's present festival better, given its kinship to it, and would also have the immense merit of being a true account rather than an invented myth? How and where could we find others if we let this one go? There's no way. No, with good luck on our side, you three should speak. And I, in return for yesterday's speeches, should now sit quietly and listen in turn.
Well, consider, Socrates, the arrangement of hospitality we've made for you. We decided that Timaeus, since he's the most versed in astronomy among us, and has made it his particular business to know about the nature of the universe, should speak first, beginning from the birth of the cosmos and ending with the nature of man. I should come after him, taking over from him human beings already brought into existence by his account, and some of them, in your account, given an outstanding education. And then, bringing them in according to Solon's story and law, I should make them citizens of this city here before us as judges, treating them as those Athenians of old whose existence, though hidden from us, was revealed by the report in the sacred writings. And from there on, I should speak of them as citizens, as actual Athenians already.
It seems I'm going to receive a complete and splendid feast of speeches in return. So it would be your task now, Timaeus, to speak next, it seems, once you've called on the gods as custom requires.
Well, Socrates, that much at least everyone does who has even a small share of good sense. At the outset of any undertaking, small or great, they always call upon a god. And we, who are about to give an account of the universe, how it came to be, or perhaps has no becoming at all, must, unless we're altogether off course, invoke gods and goddesses and pray that everything we say will be above all to their liking, and follow from that to ours as well. So much, then, for the invocation of the gods, but we must also invoke what belongs to us, so that you may most easily learn, and I may best set forth what I have in mind concerning the matters before us. In my view, then, we must begin by distinguishing this. What is the thing that exists forever and never comes to be, and what is the thing forever coming to be yet never truly existing? The one is grasped by understanding, with the aid of reasoning, since it is always the same. The other is the object of opinion, aided by unreasoning perception, since it comes to be and passes away and never really is at all. Now everything that comes to be must of necessity come to be through some cause, for it is impossible for anything to come into being without a cause. So whenever the craftsman, in fashioning something's look and character, keeps his gaze fixed on what is always the same, using a model of that kind, the result must of necessity turn out beautiful. But whenever he looks instead to something that has come to be, using a generated model, the result is not beautiful. As for the whole heaven, or cosmos, or whatever other name it would most readily accept, let it be called by that name for us. We must first examine concerning it what one is supposed to examine first about anything, whether it has always existed, having no beginning of its becoming, or whether it has come to be, starting from some beginning. It has come to be, for it is visible and tangible and has a body, and all things of that kind are perceptible, and perceptible things, grasped by opinion together with perception, have shown themselves to be things that come to be and are generated. And of that which has come to be, we say it is necessary that it came to be through some cause. Now to discover the maker and father of this universe is a task, and having discovered him, to speak of him to everyone is impossible. But we must go back and examine this further question about him. After which of the two models did the builder construct it? The one that is always the same and unchanging, or the one that has come to be? Well, if this cosmos is beautiful and its craftsman good, clearly he looked to the eternal model. But if what cannot even be said without impiety were the case, he looked to the one that has come to be. It is clear to everyone that he looked to the eternal one, for the cosmos is the most beautiful of things that have come to be, and he is the best of causes. Having come to be in this way, it has been fashioned after the model graspable by reason and understanding, the one that is always the same. Given this, it follows of necessity that this cosmos is an image of something. Now it is of the greatest importance in every matter to begin at the point nature intends. So concerning both the image and its model, we must make this distinction, that accounts are akin to the very things they set forth. Accounts of what is stable and secure and evident to understanding should themselves be stable and unshifting, so far as it is possible and fitting for accounts to be irrefutable and unassailable. Nothing of that should be lacking. But accounts of what is merely made in the likeness of that other, being itself only an image, should be merely likely, standing in the same proportion to the former as becoming stands to being. So if Socrates, in speaking about many things concerning gods and the coming to be of the universe, we turn out unable to give an account in every way consistent with itself and exact, do not be surprised. Rather, if we furnish an account no less likely than anyone else's, we should be content, remembering that both I who speak and you who judge are only human by nature, so that it is fitting to accept the likely story about these things and not search further beyond it.
Excellent, Timaeus. We must accept it entirely on your own terms. We have received your prelude admirably. Go on now and complete the main performance for us.
Let us then say for what reason the one who framed becoming and this universe framed them. He was good, and in one who is good no envy of anything ever arises. Being free of envy, he wished all things to come to be as much like himself as possible. This principle, above all, one would be most right to accept from wise men as the most authoritative source of becoming and of the cosmos. For the god, wishing that all things should be good, and so far as possible, nothing bad, took over all that was visible, not at rest, but moving in a discordant and disorderly way, and brought it from disorder into order, judging that order was in every way better than disorder. It neither was nor is permissible for the best to do anything other than what is most beautiful. So, reasoning it out, he found that among things visible by nature, no work devoid of intelligence could ever, as a whole, be more beautiful than one endowed with intelligence, taken as a whole. And further, that intelligence could not come to be present in anything apart from soul. For this reason, reasoning thus, he constructed the whole by placing intelligence in soul and soul in body, so as to bring to completion a work that would be by nature as beautiful and as good as possible. In this way, then, following the likely account, we must say that this cosmos came to be, through the god's providence, a living creature possessing soul and intelligence in very truth. Given this, we must next say to which of the living creatures he made it resemble when he framed it. Let us not judge it worthy to resemble any of those creatures that exist as parts, for nothing resembling something incomplete could ever come to be beautiful. But let us posit that it resembles, more than anything, that of which the other living creatures, individually and by kind, are parts. For that living creature contains within itself all the intelligible living creatures, just as this cosmos contains us and all the other creatures that have been formed and are visible. For the god, wishing to make it resemble as closely as possible the most beautiful of intelligible things and the most complete in every way, constructed it as a single visible living creature, containing within itself all the living creatures that are by nature akin to it. Have we then been right to speak of a single heaven, or would it have been more correct to speak of many, indeed infinitely many? It must be one, if it is to have been fashioned after its model. For that which encompasses all the intelligible living creatures, there are could never be one of a pair together with another. For then, there would have to be yet another living creature encompassing those two, of which they would be parts, and it would then be more correct to say that this world was made in the likeness not of those two, but of that encompassing third. So in order that this world should resemble the all-complete living creature in respect of its uniqueness, the Maker made not two worlds, nor an infinite number, but this single, uniquely begotten heaven has come to be and continues to exist. Now what has come to be must be bodily, and so visible and tangible, and yet nothing could ever become visible apart from fire, nor tangible without something solid, nor solid without earth. Hence the god, beginning to construct the body of the universe, made it out of fire and earth. But two things by themselves cannot be beautifully joined in the absence of a third. Some bond has to stand between them, drawing the pair together. And the most beautiful of bonds is one that makes itself and the things it binds as fully one as possible, and this is naturally best accomplished by proportion. For whenever among three numbers, whether they are volumes or powers of any kind, the middle one stands to the last as the first stands to it, and again the last stands to the middle as the middle stands to the first, then, since the middle becomes both first and last, and the last and the first in turn both become middles, all of them will, of necessity, turn out to be the same in relation to one another, and being the same relative to one another, they will all be one. Now if the body of the universe had needed to be a plain surface, with no depth at all, one mean alone would have been enough to link it with its companion terms. But as it is, it was fitting for it to be solid in form, and solids are never joined by one mean alone, but always require two means working together. So the God set water and air between fire and earth, and made them, so far as possible, proportionate to one another, so that fire stands to air as air stands to water, and air stands to water as water stands to earth. Binding them in this way, he framed the heaven, visible and tangible. On this account, the body of the cosmos was generated out of elements of this kind, four in number, brought into harmony by proportion, and from this it acquired friendship, so that, having come together into unity with itself, it is indissoluble by anything other than the one who bound it. And of the four elements, the constitution of the cosmos has taken up each one whole. For the one who constructed it made it out of all the fire, water, air, and earth there is, leaving no part or power of any of them outside, with this intention. First, that it might be as complete a living whole as possible, made of complete parts. And further, one, since nothing was left over from which another such creature might come to be, and moreover, so that it might be free from old age and disease, observing how heat and cold and all things that have strong powers, when they surround a compound body and fall upon it out of season, dissolve it, and bring on diseases and old age, causing it to waste away. For this reason and by this reasoning, he fashioned it as a single whole, made of all wholes, complete, free from old age and disease. And he gave it the shape that was fitting and akin to it. For a living creature meant to contain within itself all living creatures, the fitting shape would be the one that encompasses within itself all the shapes there are. Therefore he turned it, spherical in form, equidistant in every direction from the center to the extremities, a round shape, the most complete of all shapes and the most like itself, since he judged the like unimaginably more beautiful than the unlike. And all around, on the outside, he made it smooth all over for many reasons. It had no need of eyes, since nothing visible was left outside it, nor of hearing, since there was nothing to be heard either. There was no air surrounding it requiring breath, nor again did it need any organ by which to take in nourishment into itself, and afterward expel what had already been drained of its use. For nothing departed from it, and nothing came to it from anywhere. There was nowhere for anything to come from, since it was made by design to furnish its own waste as its own nourishment, and to act and be acted upon entirely within and by itself. For its maker judged that it would be better self-sufficient than dependent on anything else. And since it had no need to grasp anything with hands, nor to fend anything off, he thought it pointless to attach hands to it in vain, or feet either, or any other apparatus for standing and walking. TIMAUS, he assigned to it the motion proper to its body, that one of the seven motions which belongs most to intellect and understanding. So he turned it about uniformly in the same place and within itself, and made it revolve in a circle, and took away from it all the other six motions, so that it would not wander through any of them. And since this revolution needed no feet, he brought it into being without legs and without feet. This whole plan, then, conceived by a God who always is, concerning a God who was to be, produced a body smooth and even all over, equal from the center in every direction, whole and complete, made of complete bodies. And placing soul in its center, he stretched it through the whole and further wrapped the body round with it on the outside. And so he set it revolving in a circle, a single heaven, alone, capable through its own excellence of keeping company with itself and needing nothing else, sufficiently acquainted with and friendly to itself. On all these accounts, he begot it a blessed God. As for the soul, he did not, as we are now attempting to describe, contrive it later than the body. We speak of it that way largely because we share so much in what is haphazard and random. But the God constructed the soul prior to the body and older than it, both in birth and in excellence, to be the body's mistress and ruler, its ruler to be, and he put it together out of the following materials, and in the following way. Out of the indivisible substance that is always the same, and the substance that becomes divided among bodies, he blended a third form of substance, in between the two, from both of them, concerned with the nature of the same, and again, with that of the different, and he set it in composition midway between their undivided element and that which is divided among bodies. Taking these three, he blended them all into a single form, forcing the nature of the different, which resisted mixing, into union with the same. Having mixed these together with substance and made one out of three, he then cut the whole up into however many portions were appropriate, every one of them a blend of the same, the different, and substance. He began the division this way. First he took away one portion from the whole. After this, he took away a portion double that, a third, 1.5 times the second and 3 times the first, a fourth, double the second, a fifth, 3 times the third, a sixth, 8 times the first, and a seventh, 27 times the first. After this, he filled up the double and triple intervals, cutting off further portions from the original mixture and placing them in between, so that within each interval there were two means, one exceeding and being exceeded by the same fraction of the extremes, the other exceeding and being exceeded by an equal number. These bonds produced intervals of 3/2, 4/3, and 9/8 within the previous intervals, and he filled up all the 4/3 intervals with the 9/8 interval, leaving over in each case a fraction, the interval of this leftover fraction having its terms in the ratio of 256 to 243. And by this point the mixture from which he was cutting these portions was completely used up. He then split this whole compound lengthwise into two, and joining the 2/2 to each other at their middles like the letter X, he bent them round into a circle, joining each to itself, and to the other at the point opposite the original juncture, and he set them revolving together in the motion that turns uniformly in the same place, making one circle the outer, the other the inner. The outer revolution he named the motion of the same, the inner that of the different. The circle of the same he made revolve to the right along its side, that of the different to the left along its diagonal, and he gave dominance to the revolution of the same and the uniform, for he left it single and undivided, while the inner circle he split 6 times, making 7 unequal circles, following the intervals of the double and the triple 3 of each, and he directed the circles to travel counter to one another, assigning 3 of them an equal speed. The other 4 at speeds unequal both to one another and to the first 3, but all moving in due proportion. Now when the whole composition of the soul had come to be according to the mind of its composer, after this, he built within it the whole corporeal frame and fitted the 2 together, center to center. And the soul, woven throughout from the center to the outermost heaven and enveloping it all round from outside, itself revolving within itself, began a divine, unceasing, intelligent life lasting through all time. So the body of the heavens came to be visible, but the soul itself is invisible, sharing in reasoning and harmony, the best of things brought into being, made by the best of causes, among things that are perceptible by intellect, and are always the same. Since it is blended out of the natures of the same and of the different, and of substance, these 3 ingredients, and divided and bound together in due proportion, and since it circles back upon itself, whenever it comes into contact with something whose substance is scattered, or with something undivided, it speaks, moving through the whole of itself, telling what a thing is the same as, and what it is different from, and in what relation especially. And where and how, and when it happens, that each thing stands to each in the realm of becoming, both in being acted on and in acting, and in relation to what remains always the same. And when this account comes to be equally true both about the different and about the same, moving voicelessly and soundlessly within the self-moved, whenever it concerns the perceptible and the circle of the different runs true and reports it to the whole soul, then firm and true opinions and beliefs arise. And whenever, again, its object is rational, and it is the circle of the same that runs smoothly and discloses it, then understanding and knowledge are necessarily brought to completion. And should anyone ever call the thing in which these two arise anything other than soul, he will be saying anything rather than the truth. Now when the Father who had begotten it saw it set in motion and alive, a shrine brought into being for the everlasting gods, he was well pleased, and in his delight he took thought to make it still more like its model. So just as that model happens to be an everlasting living being, he undertook to make this universe, too, so far as possible, of that same character. Now the nature of the living being was in fact eternal, and this could not be fully attached to what is generated. So he took thought to make a kind of moving image of eternity, and in the very act of ordering the heaven he made, of eternity abiding in unity, an image moving according to number, that to which we have given the name time. For days and nights and months and years did not exist before the heaven came to be, but he devised their coming into being together with the heaven's own composition. All these are parts of time, and was, and will be, are forms of time that have come to be, which we mistakenly, without noticing, apply to the everlasting substance. For we say that it was, is, and will be, but strictly speaking only is truly belongs to it, while was and will be are properly said of the becoming that proceeds in time, for these are motions, whereas that which is always the same unmoving is not fitting to become either older or younger through time, nor ever to have become so, nor to be now become, nor to be about to become hereafter, nor in general to be subject to anything which becoming has attached to things that move in the realm of sense. Rather, these are forms of time that have come to be in imitation of eternity and circling, according to number. And besides these, there are further expressions of the same kind, such as that what has become is what has become, and what is becoming is what is becoming, and again, that what is to become is what is to become, and that what is not is what is not, none of which we speak with any precision. But perhaps this is not the proper occasion to go into these matters with exactness. Time then came into being together with the heaven, so that, having been generated together, they might also be dissolved together, should a dissolution of them ever come to pass. And it was made after the pattern of the eternal nature, so that it might be as like that pattern as possible. For the pattern is a being for all eternity, while the heaven, throughout the whole of time, has been and is and will be. Out of this reasoning and design of God for the generation of time, in order that time might be born, the sun, the moon, and five further stars, the ones nicknamed wanderers, came into being for marking and preserving the numbers of time, and having made bodies for each of them, the God set them into the orbits along which the revolution of the different was passing, seven bodies in seven orbits, the moon in the one nearest the earth, the sun in the second above the earth. The morning star, and the one called sacred to Hermes, he set moving in the circle that keeps pace in speed with the sun's, though endowed with a power opposite to it, which is why the sun and the star of Hermes and the morning star overtake, and are overtaken by one another in turn. As for the rest, where and for what reasons he set each one, were one to go through them all, the account, being a digression, would give more trouble than the matters for whose sake it is told. These things may perhaps later, at leisure, receive the treatment they deserve. But when each of the bodies that needed to work together to produce time had come to the motion proper to it, and their bodies bound by living bonds had been born as living creatures and learned their appointed task, then, following the motion of the different, which is oblique, and is carried through and mastered by the motion of the same, one moving in a larger, another in a smaller circle, those in the smaller circle moving faster, those in the larger more slowly. Now because of the motion of the same, the bodies moving fastest appeared to be overtaken by those moving more slowly, even though they were really overtaking them. For this motion, twisting all their circles into a spiral, since they move forward at once in two opposite directions, made whatever moved away from it most slowly appear nearest to it, since it itself is the fastest of all. And so that there might be some clear measure of their relative slowness and speed, by which the eight revolutions might proceed, the God kindled a light in the orbit second from the earth, which we now call the sun, so that it might shine as far as possible over the whole heaven, and so that all the living things for whom it was fitting might share in number, learning it from the revolution of the same and uniform. So night and day came to be in this way, and for this reason, being the period of the single, most intelligent revolution, a month, whenever the moon, having gone round its own circle, overtakes the sun, a year, whenever the sun has gone round its own circle. As for the periods of the others, human beings, except for a few among the many, have not taken note of them, and neither name them nor measure them against one another by numbers, so that they scarcely know that time is in fact the wanderings of these bodies, bewildering in their multitude and marvelously intricate. Nevertheless, it is no less possible to grasp that the perfect number of time fulfills the perfect year at that moment when the relative speeds of all eight revolutions, having completed their courses together, reach ahead, as measured by the circle of the same and uniformly moving. It was in accordance with this plan, and for this purpose, that those of the stars which pass through the heavens and undergo turnings were begotten, so that this universe might be as like as possible to the complete and intelligible living being, in imitation of its everlasting nature. Now, in other respects, the work had already been carried, up to the generation of time, into likeness with that on which it was modeled. But in this respect, it still fell short of likeness, that it did not yet contain within itself all the living creatures that were to come into being. This remaining task he now went on to complete, shaping the universe after the nature of the pattern. Just as intellect discerns the forms present in the living being that truly is, of what sort and how many they are, so he judged that this universe too should possess the same kind and number of them. There are four kinds of living things. One is the heavenly race of gods, another is winged and travels through the air, a third is the watery kind, and a fourth goes on foot on dry land. Of the divine kind, he fashioned the greatest part out of fire, so that it might be as bright and beautiful to look at as possible, and making it resemble the universe, he made it perfectly round, and set it in the understanding of that most excellent thing, to follow along with it, distributing it in a circle all around the heavens, so that it might be a true cosmos, adorned throughout its whole. And he attached two motions to each, one in the same place, turning always in the same way, always thinking the selfsame things concerning the selfsame objects, the other a forward motion, held in check by the circuit of what is same and uniform. But from the other five motions, he kept it unmoved and at rest, so that each of them might become as excellent as possible. And it is from this cause that all the fixed stars have come to be living beings, divine and eternal, which forever remain revolving in the same place and in the same manner, while those that turn and wander in the way described earlier came to be in accordance with that account. As for the earth, our nurse, coiled as it is around the axis stretched through the whole universe, he devised it as the guardian and maker of night and day, the first and eldest of all the gods that have come to be within the heavens. To describe the dances of these gods themselves, and their approaches to one another, and the counter-revolutions and advances of their circles, and which of the gods come into conjunction with which and which stand opposite, and in what order they pass in front of one another, and at what times each is hidden from us and again reappears, sending fears and signs of what is to come to those unable to reason, to speak of all this without the aid of a visual model of these very motions would be a wasted effort. Let this, then, and what has been said about the visible and generated gods suffice, and let it have its end here. But concerning the other divinities, to speak of their origin and to know it is beyond us, and we must trust those who spoke of it before, who were, as they claimed, offspring of gods, and surely knew their own ancestors well. It is impossible to disbelieve the children of gods, even though they speak without probable or necessary proofs. Rather, since they profess to be reporting their own family history, we must believe them, in accordance with custom. Let our account of the birth of these gods, then, stand and be told just as they told it. Earth and heaven had as children Oceanus and Tethys, and from these came Phorces and Cronus and Rhea and all the rest with them. And from Cronus and Rhea came Zeus and Hera and all those we know to be called their siblings, and still others descended from these. Now once all the gods had come to be, both those who visibly circle the heavens and those who appear only as far as they wish, the one who begot this whole universe spoke to them as follows. Gods, gods of whom I am the maker and father of your works, whatever has come to be through me is indissoluble, so long as I do not will otherwise. Now everything that is bound can be dissolved, but to wish to dissolve what has been well fitted together and is in good condition would be the mark of an evil being. Therefore, since you have come into being, you are not immortal nor wholly indissoluble. Yet you shall not be dissolved, nor shall you meet the fate of death, since you have been allotted a bond even greater and more sovereign than those bonds with which you were bound together when you came to be the bond of my will. Now then, learn what I am telling you and pointing out to you. There remain still three mortal kinds not yet begotten, and if these are not brought into being, the heavens will be incomplete, for they will not contain within themselves all the kinds of living things, and they must, if the heavens are to be sufficiently complete. Yet if these came to be through me and shared in life, they would be equal to gods. So that mortality may belong to them, and that this universe may be complete in the fullest sense, turn yourselves, according to your nature, to the crafting of living things, imitating the power I used in your own begetting. And insofar as it is fitting for a part of them to bear the same name as the immortals, called the divine part, and ruling within them in those who are ever willing to follow justice and to follow you, I will sow that part and set it going, and then hand it over to you. The rest of the task is yours. Weave what is mortal onto what is immortal, fashion living things, give them growth by feeding them, and receive them back again when they waste away. So he spoke, and once more into the same mixing bowl in which he had blended and mixed the soul of the universe, he poured what remained of the earlier ingredients, mixing them in much the same manner, though no longer as pure and unmixed as before, but now second and third in purity. And having composed the whole, he portioned it out into as many souls as there are stars, allotting one soul to each star, and mounting them as it were upon a vehicle, he displayed to them the universe's nature and declared to them the laws that were fated for them, that there would be a single ordained first birth appointed for all alike, so that none should be slighted by him, and that once sown, each into the instrument of time suited to it, they should grow into the most God-fearing of living things. And that since human nature is twofold, the superior kind would be that which would afterward be called man. Once these souls were of necessity implanted in bodies, and matter flowed into and out of their bodies, it was necessary first that a single sensation, common to all, should arise in them from violent impressions. Second, a desire mixed with pleasure and pain, and besides these, fear and anger, and whatever follows upon these, and whatever is naturally opposed and stands apart from them. If they were to master these, they would live justly, if mastered by them, unjustly. And whoever lived well for his appointed time would return again to dwell in his companion star, and there live a happy life in keeping with his character. But whoever failed in this would, at his second birth, pass over into a woman's nature. And if even then he did not cease from wickedness, then in the manner in which he continued to grow base, he would keep changing, according to the likeness of his character, into some such bestial nature, and there would be no release for him from these labors and changes of shape, until, following along with the revolution of the same and uniform within him, he mastered by reason that great accreted mass of fire, water, air, and earth that had later attached itself to him, turbulent and irrational as it was. And thus arrived again at the form of his first and best condition. Having ordained all these things as law for them, so that he himself might be blameless for the wickedness each of them would afterward commit, he sowed some of them into the earth, some into the moon, and others into the other instruments of time. And after this sowing, he handed over to the young gods the task of molding mortal bodies, and of fashioning and governing whatever remained still needed to complete the human soul, along with all that follows from it, and of ruling and, as far as possible, guiding this mortal living being in the finest and best way, so that it might not become, through its own fault, a cause of evils to itself. And he who had arranged all these things remained, in his own fashion, within his own accustomed way of being. While he remained, his children took note of their father's ordinance and obeyed it. Taking the immortal starting point of a mortal living being, and imitating their own maker, they took on loan from the cosmos portions of fire, of earth, of water, and of air, on the understanding that these would be repaid again, and welded together what they took, not with the indissoluble bonds by which they themselves were held together, but fusing it with tiny, invisible rivets set close together, forming out of all the parts a single body for each. And into this body, subject to inflow and outflow, they bound the revolutions of the immortal soul. Bound as they were to this great river, these revolutions neither mastered it nor were mastered by it, but were carried along and carried it along by force, so that the whole living creature was moved, but proceeded in a disorderly and irrational way, however it happened, possessing all six motions, for it wandered forward and backward, and again rightward and leftward, downward and upward, and every which way through all six directions. For since the wave that brought in and carried off nourishment was great, it produced yet greater turmoil through the disturbances caused whenever a body collided with some foreign fire from outside, or struck a solid mass of earth, or slid upon the wet slipperiness of waters, or was overtaken by a stormy blast of winds borne by the air. And by all of these, motions carried through the body toward the soul struck upon it. It was on account of all this, indeed, that they were then called, and are still now called, collectively, sensations. And it was then, at that very moment, that they produced the greatest and most extensive motion. Joining with the ceaselessly flowing stream, and shaking violently the revolutions of the soul, they utterly hindered the revolution of the same, flowing against it, and checked it as it tried to rule and to proceed, while they shook up the revolution of the different so violently that the three intervals of the double and the three of the triple, and the mean terms and connecting links of the ratios of 3:2, 4:3, and 9:8. Since they could not be entirely dissolved except by the one who bound them together, were twisted into every kind of turn, and produced every sort of break and disruption of the circles, as far as this was possible, so that these circles, barely holding together with one another, moved indeed, but moved irrationally, sometimes in reverse, sometimes obliquely, and sometimes upside down. It is as when someone, lying on his back with his head propped against the ground, and his feet thrust up and resting against something above, in this condition, both for the one undergoing it, and for those looking on, right appears as left and left as right, to each in relation to the other. This very thing and other things like it happen violently to the revolutions, whenever they encounter something from outside that belongs either to the kind of the same or to that of the different, and then, calling the same different and the different the same in some particular case, they contradict the truth and become false and unintelligent, and at that time there is in them no revolution that rules or leads. And whenever certain sensations, born in from outside and striking against them, drag along with them the entire vessel of the soul, then these revolutions, though actually mastered, seem to be the masters. And it is on account of all these disturbances that the soul, now as in the beginning, becomes unintelligent at first, whenever it is bound to a mortal body. But when the stream of growth and nourishment flows in less strongly, and the revolutions, regaining themselves, proceed along their own path and settle down more, as time goes on, then at last, as each of the circles is directed toward its shape according to nature, and they call the different and the same by their right names, they render the one who possesses them intelligent. And if some correct nurture of education joins in and assists, such a person becomes whole and entirely healthy, having escaped the greatest disease. But if he is negligent, he passes through life lame and returns again to Hades incomplete and unintelligent. This, however, happens only later on. As for what has now been proposed, we must go through it more precisely, and before that, concerning the generation of the parts of the body, and concerning the soul, we must go through the causes and providences of the gods by which they came about, holding fast always to what is most probable, and proceeding accordingly. The two divine revolutions, then, imitating the shape of the universe, which is spherical, they bound into a spherical body, that which we now call the head, which is the most divine part, and rules over all that is within us. To it, the gods gave the whole body as its servant, having assembled it, since they understood that it would partake of all the motions there were to be. So that it might not, rolling upon the ground, which has heights and depths of every kind, be at a loss how to climb over some and descend from others, they gave it this as a vehicle and means of easy passage. This then is why the body acquired length, and grew four limbs, extendable and bendable, once the god had devised a means of locomotion, limbs by which it could take hold of things and push against them, and so make its way through every region, carrying above us the dwelling place of what is most divine and most sacred in us. Legs and hands, then, grew onto all creatures for this reason and toward this end. And because the gods regarded the front as more honorable and more fit to lead than the back, they gave us, accordingly, most of our capacity for motion in that direction. So it was necessary that the front of a human being's body be marked off and made unlike the rest. That is why, first of all, around the vessel of the head, they set the face in place there and bound into it organs for the whole forethought of the soul, and arranged that this, the part naturally in front, should be the part that shares in leadership. And of these organs, the first they fashioned together were the light-bearing eyes, binding them in for the following reason. Whatever portion of fire does not burn, but instead yields a gentle light suited to each day, they contrived to make into a body of its own. For the fire within us, being akin to that outer fire, they made pure and smooth, and caused to flow through the eyes, dense throughout, but especially compressed at the middle of the eyes, so that it holds back everything coarser, and lets only that pure kind filter through by itself. So whenever the light of day encircles the visual current, like issues forth to meet like, the two coalesce, and a single homogeneous body is formed along the straight line of sight, wherever the fire from within strikes against whatever it meets from outside. And because this whole body has become alike through likeness, whatever it touches, and whatever touches it, transmits its motions throughout the body all the way to the soul, and produces that sensation which we call seeing. But when the kindred fire departs into night, the connection is cut off, for going out toward what is unlike itself, it is altered and quenched, no longer being of one nature with the neighboring air, since that air has no fire in it. So it stops seeing, and moreover it induces sleep. For the safeguard which the gods devised for sight, the nature of the eyelids, when these close together, shuts in the power of the fire within, and this power diffuses and evens out the motions within us. And once they are evened out, stillness follows, and when the stillness is deep, a sleep with few dreams falls upon us. But when certain larger motions are left over, whatever sort they are, and in whatever regions they remain, they produce, by a corresponding process, likenesses within images which, when we are roused, are remembered as appearing outside us. As for the image-making of mirrors, and everything smooth and reflective, there is nothing difficult left to grasp. For out of the communion with one another of the fire within, and the fire without, each becoming, on each occasion, a single thing around the smooth surface, and reshaped in many ways, all such appearances necessarily show themselves, whenever the fire from the face and the fire from the sight coalesce around what is smooth and bright. What is on the left appears on the right, because contact occurs between opposite parts of the visual stream and opposite parts of the object, contrary to the usual manner of encounter, whereas right appears right and left appears left when the light, in coalescing, shifts position, which happens whenever the smoothness of the mirror, rising up on this side and that, pushes the right-hand part of the vision over to the left and the other way about. And when the mirror is turned along the length of the face, this same effect makes the whole image appear upside down, pushing what is below toward what is above in the reflected ray, and what is above back down toward what is below. Now all these are among the auxiliary causes which the guard uses as servants in bringing to completion, so far as possible, the form of what is best. Yet most people suppose them not auxiliary causes, but the causes of everything, since they cool and heat, condense and disperse, and produce all such effects. But in truth, these things are capable of no reasoning and no intelligence about anything. For among the things that exist, the one to which alone it belongs to possess intelligence must be called soul. And soul is invisible, while fire, water, earth, and air have all come into being as bodies open to sight. So the lover of intelligence and knowledge must pursue first the causes belonging to a rational nature, and only second those which, being moved by other things, in turn move still others by necessity. And we too must do the same. Both kinds of causes must be spoken of, but kept distinct. Those which, working with intelligence, are craftsmen of things fine and good, and those which, left alone without understanding, produce on each occasion whatever happens to come about, without order. Let this, then, be said about the eyes, and their part in the working out of the power they now possess. But now I must speak of the greatest benefit they provide, on account of which the God has bestowed them on us as a gift. Sight, in my account, has become the cause of the greatest benefit to us, because none of our present accounts about the universe could ever have been given if we had never seen the stars, the sun, or the sky. But as it is, the sight of day and night, of months and the cycles of years, of equinoxes and solstices, has enabled the invention of number, and given us the concept of time and the capacity to inquire into the nature of the whole. And from these, we have derived the pursuit we call philosophy, than which no greater good has ever come, or ever will come, as a gift from the gods to mortal kind. This, I say, is the greatest benefit of the eyes. Why should we praise all the lesser benefits, which a person who lacks philosophy would only lament, blind and grieving, in vain? Let us instead say this: the reason and purpose for which the God invented and gave us sight is so that we might observe the courses of intelligence in the heavens and put them to use for the revolutions of our own thinking, which are akin to those, though ours are disturbed while theirs are undisturbed. And by learning them thoroughly and coming to share in the correctness of reasoning that accords with nature, we might, by imitating the utterly unwandering courses of the God, bring order to the wandering courses within ourselves. The same account holds again for voice and hearing, that these two were given by the gods for the same purposes and to the same end. For speech has been ordained for these very purposes, contributing the greatest share toward them, and as much of it as is useful for hearing, for the sake of harmony, has been given for the purposes of music. And harmony, whose motions are akin to the revolutions of the soul within us, has been given by the muses, to one who makes intelligent use of them, not for irrational pleasure, as it now seems to be used, but as an ally against the discordant revolution that has arisen in our soul, to bring it into order and concord with itself. And rhythm, likewise, was given by the same gods for the same purpose, as a help against the graceless and measureless condition that prevails in most of us. Now everything said up to this point, with a few exceptions, has displayed what has been fashioned by intelligence, but we must also set alongside our account what comes about through necessity. For the coming to be of this universe was a mixed result, from a combination of necessity and intelligence. Intelligence ruled over necessity by persuading it to guide most of what comes to be toward what is best. And it was in this way, through necessity yielding to intelligent persuasion, that this universe was originally put together. So if someone is to say truly how it actually came to be, in accordance with this account, he must also bring in the character of the wandering cause, in whatever way it is naturally suited to carry things along. We must go back again in this way, and taking a fresh starting point suited to these matters themselves, we must begin again from the beginning about them, just as we did before about the earlier subjects. We must consider the nature of fire, water, air, and earth in themselves, prior to the coming to be of the heavens, and the states they were in before that. For up to now no one has yet explained their origin. Instead we speak as if we knew what fire is, and each of the others, and set them down as the elements, the letters, so to speak, of the universe, though it would not even be fitting to compare them, plausibly, to the level of syllables, by anyone with even a little sense. For now, then, let our own position on this be as follows. As to the principle, or principles of all things, or whatever view one holds about them, I shall not speak of it now, for no other reason than that it is difficult, given the present manner of our exposition, to make clear what I think about it. So neither should you expect me to speak of it, nor could I persuade myself that I would be right to undertake so great a task. Rather, holding fast to what was said at the outset, the power of likely accounts, I shall try to give an account no less likely than any other, indeed more so, starting again from the beginning about each thing and about all things together. So invoking the God once more at the start of what is to be said, as a Savior to bring us safely through a strange and unaccustomed exposition to a doctrine of likelihood, let us begin speaking again. Now this fresh beginning about the universe must be divided more fully than before, for then we distinguished two kinds, but now we must make clear to ourselves a third kind besides. The two kinds were sufficient for what was said before, one posited as the form of a model, intelligible and always the same, and a second, the copy of the model, subject to coming to be and visible. A third kind we did not distinguish at that time, supposing those two would suffice. The argument now, however, appears to compel us to attempt to bring to light in words a form that is difficult and obscure. What power and nature, then, should we suppose it has? This above all, that it is the receptacle of all coming to be, its nurse, so to speak. Now this is true, but it must be stated more clearly, and that is difficult, especially because it requires that we first raise puzzles about fire and the things that go with fire for this very reason. It is difficult to say of any one of them which sort really deserves to be called water rather than fire, or which sort deserves any other name rather than all of them, or each of them individually, in a way that would let us use any trustworthy and stable account. How then, and in what way, and with what likely reasoning about them should we speak, once we have raised these puzzles? First, what we have just now called water, we see, when it congeals, becoming, as we suppose, stones and earth. But when it melts and disperses, this same thing becomes vapor and air when burned together becomes fire, and in the reverse direction fire when compressed and quenched passes back again into the form of air, and air once more coming together and condensing becomes cloud and mist, and from these, compressed still further, flows water. And from water, earth and stones again, thus handing on, it appears, coming to be in a circle from one to another. Since then none of these things ever appears the same, who would not be ashamed to insist stubbornly that any one of them is, with certainty, this thing and no other? No one would, rather, it is far safer to speak of them as follows. Whenever we see something continually becoming other and other, fire, say we should call it not this, but that which is such, each time, fire, and not this, but that which is such, always, water, and nothing else, ever, as though it had any stability, whatever we point to using the words this and that, supposing thereby to indicate something. For it flees, refusing to abide the designation this, and that, and thereof, and every phrase that points to them as fixed and existing things. Rather we should not speak of each of them this way, but call whatever recurrently appears alike, in each case and in all together, the such, and so call fire, in particular, that which is throughout of this sort, and likewise everything else that has coming to be. TIMAUS, as for that in which each of these qualities is always appearing, and from which it again perishes, to that alone do the names, this and that, properly apply, but whatever has some quality, hot, or white, or any of the opposites, and all the things composed of these, none of that should we call that. Let me try to put this more clearly still. Suppose someone molds every shape there is out of gold, and never stops remolding each one into all the others. If someone pointed at one of them and asked what it was, the answer truest and safest by a wide margin would be gold, and never to speak of the triangle or whatever other shape has come to be in it, as though these were things that are, since they shift, even while one is in the act of naming them. Rather, one should be content if it will accept even that description with some measure of safety. The same account holds for the nature that receives all bodies. It must always be called the same, for it never departs at all from its own power. It is always receiving all things, and it has never taken on any shape at all like any of the things that enter it in any way whatsoever. For by nature it lies there as a matrix for everything, set in motion and marked with shapes by the things that enter it, and because of them it appears different at different times, while the things that enter and leave are always imitations of the things that are, stamped from them in some manner hard to describe and wonderful, which we shall pursue later. For the present, then, we must have in mind three kinds: that which comes to be, that in which it comes to be, and that from which the thing coming to be grows, in likeness to it. And it is fitting to compare the receiving thing to a mother, that from which it grows to a father, and the nature between the two to their offspring, and to understand that if an impression is to display every variety of appearance, that very thing in which the impression is to be set could not be well prepared unless it were itself formless, free of all those characters which it is to receive from elsewhere. For if it were similar to any of the things entering it, then whenever things of the opposite character or of an entirely different nature came upon it in its receiving, it would render them badly, since it would show through with its own appearance mingled in. That is why the thing that is to receive within itself all the kinds must be free of all form, just as with fragrant ointments, the craftsmen who prepare them first see to it that the liquids meant to receive the scents are as odorless as possible, and those who attempt to press shapes into anything soft take care that no shape at all is visible in it beforehand, but smooth it out and make it as level as they can. TIMAUS, the same holds then for that which is to receive well, many times over, throughout itself, the likenesses of all the things that always are. It must by nature be free of all the forms. That is why we should not call the mother and receptacle of what has come to be, visible and altogether perceptible, earth or air or fire or water, nor any of the things composed of these, nor any of the things from which these come, but rather in calling it a kind that is invisible and formless, all receiving and partaking of the intelligible in some most perplexing way, most difficult to grasp, we shall not be speaking falsely. And so far as it is possible, from what has been said, to arrive at its nature, one might put it most correctly this way: fire is always the part of it that has been kindled that appears as such, water the part that has been moistened, and earth and air appear so far as it receives imitations of these. But we should examine this more closely by reasoning things out as follows. Is there some fire that is just by itself, and all the other things about which we always speak in this way, as each being a thing in itself? Or are the very things we see, and all the things we perceive through the body, alone the things that have this kind of reality, with nothing else existing besides these anywhere at all? And are we saying in vain, every time, that there is some intelligible form of each thing, when this is nothing but a form of words? Now it would not be right to let the present question go untried and unjudged, simply asserting that things stand thus, nor should we tack on some further digression to an argument already long. But if some great distinction could be drawn in a few words, that would be most opportune of all. This, then, is how I cast my own vote. If understanding and true opinion are two distinct kinds, then these things exist entirely on their own, forms imperceptible to us, objects of thought alone. But if, as it seems to some, true opinion differs in no way from understanding, then everything we perceive through the body must be set down as the most stable reality there is. Now we must say these are two, because they have come to be separately and are unlike in character. For the one comes to be in us through teaching, the other through persuasion. The one is always accompanied by a true account, the other has none. The one cannot be moved by persuasion, the other can be changed by it. And of true opinion, we must say, every man has a share, but of understanding, only the gods, and but a small portion of humankind.